girls. What? Keep it fresh.
Hi, welcome to Female Trouble. I'm Quinn Kelly, and this is a podcast spotlighting women in Baltimore. In their own words, Outcalls are electronic opera queens. The band is Britt Olsen Ecker and Melissa Wimbish, who build on their classical training to craft soulful, vocal-forward indie pop. Outcalls was founded in 2015, and Britt and Melissa later split off to form the current iteration of the band. Last year, they released the acclaimed EP, No King. Britt and Melissa talked about imposter syndrome, ambition, and getting comfortable with controversy. Here's our conversation. How did the two of you meet?
Gosh, we met through Peabody.
Yeah.
People. Yeah, we didn't go to school at the same time, but knew some mutual friends.
Yeah, we had an audition for Single Carrot Theater.
That's right.
And we were both auditioning with a mutual friend, and we were running lines in one of the parks right outside Peabody, and that was the first time we met.
Yeah.
So were you guys both, like, theater kids?
I was definitely a theater kid.
I was a wannabe theater kid. I always wanted to be theater, but I was more of a band nerd.
Okay.
Definitely a band nerd, trying to break in.
So do you remember your first, like, introduction or how it went down that first time you
met? We ran monologues.
Yeah, we did our monologues for each other. Yeah, that was...
You did one about, was it Bubblegum?
Yeah, I think you're right. That was from, it was from a show that I did at the Strand Theater, which was a theater in Baltimore that championed women's written plays and directed and acted. So that's right. That was like my contemporary monologue that I was using forever. Yeah. What, I can't remember what you did. I must have blocked it out.
I did something from, it was a Shakespeare thing, Brutus. I had to be yelling at Brutus.
That's cool. Oh, like, nice, nice.
I don't remember.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What did you each study at Peabody?
We both studied voice. Mm-hmm. Both studied voice and opera. Yeah.
What does that entail as someone who knows nothing about Peabody or opera or what it means to be in a conservatory like that?
We have to take a bunch of language classes. So not necessarily learning exactly what we're saying, but how to pronounce everything so it sounds like we know exactly what we're saying. So diction classes.
So this podcast is going to be very clear.
Exactly.
And precisely clear. Yes. Stated.
So we take diction classes in German, French, Italian, Russian.
English, too.
English
I had a thing
well.
Singing
right.
in English my right. freshman year, which is, you're like, I don't need to learn how to do this, but.
Yeah,
there are some
but
things.
You do. And you have to learn the international phonetic alphabet so that you can basically take any language and write out this IPA alphabet so that anybody can look at that alphabet and pronounce it.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to learn how to do that. You have to take classes in theory, music theory, keyboard. You have to take a bunch of ensemble classes. So
chorus.
Lots of chorus.
Yeah, chorus. Yeah. Voice lessons once a week.
Mm-hmm.
At least I did undergrad, so it was once a week.
Mm-hmm.
Coachings, which are just you and an accompanist play through things, sing through things.
And they usually coach you on language, and they say, close your, brighten your eye.
Doesn't sound quite right.
Did you enjoy it?
Say it with a smile. Yeah, yeah.
I did. It's so different, I think, than any other school. Conservatory training, and at a school like Peabody, where there are 700 people total going to school, and maybe a fraction of that are undergrad, or a fraction of that are grad students. You're being exposed to all types of instrumentalists and vocalists, recording engineers, but you're not meeting many people beyond that.
How did you kind of get beyond that and meet other people in Baltimore, if you did?
Well, I think Britt and I, one thing that we realized we had in common right away was that we never wanted to be those kinds of singers that were the, I don't know, it's not to hate on singers, but singers have a reputation for being assholes.
We can hate on singers because we are
singers. Yeah, exactly. So I think we both, before we knew each other, were always determined to put ourselves out there and not just be friends with singers, to go to the parties that not just the singers went to not engage in all of the same kind of stuffy practices that all singers did. And I think now we're in a time where I think more singers are doing that. But when we were younger or kind of embarking on our educations, it was sort of, you know, it wasn't, we were kind of the outcasts.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Would you agree?
Yeah, I think that I was so afraid of being labeled a typical opera singer that I did everything I could to distance myself from that. And there, on one hand, I'm glad I did, but on the other hand, I'm so sad that there was just this like stereotype, you know, mm-hmm. because singing is the ultimate instrument. Mm-hmm. It is the ultimate instrument. You're using your body to produce the sound. So, but I'm glad I am glad I did, because I met a lot of different people. You know, those people are still friends of mine today who I collaborate with regularly. But yeah, no, there is that stereotype. Oh, you're a crazy singer, or, you know, there's just some weird.
Yeah, you're stuck up, or.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Are you surprised to have ended up in a band like Outcalls or making pop music?
I am.
I am, definitely. I never. I always dreamed of it. I would say, like, I fantasized about being, like, a rock star. But now that we're doing it, it's like, oh, it's the happy medium of all of the things that I want to do vocally and music-wise. I'm singing. I'm playing piano. We're performing. It's such a performance.
We're writing.
We're writing. Yeah. We're recording. We're learning all about that. And we're utilizing our training. Mm-hmm. We're utilizing all of that good stuff, but in the ways that we want to do it.
Right.
Which is like, this is great.
Not in
so
the ways
fun.
I expected.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I think, well, we both still sing classical music. I mean, we have a concert coming up, you know. We're still very involved in the scene and using that technique. And I agree with Britt. I don't think I imagined it ever being like this.
Mm-hmm.
Like, this was going to be the thing to blow up.
Right.
Did you imagine being a professional classical singer?
Yeah, and I still do. I still am. But I don't know that it's as important to me anymore. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's important. I love doing it. But I think the writing and the collaborating with Britt is very important to me personally.
Mm-hmm. I never had any like illusions about being an opera singer, because everybody told me, oh, it's so hard, you know, you won't ever make it. And I'd never really wanted to. There are times that I thought, oh, I could do this if I really wanted to, but I never really wanted to. I had so many other interests. I loved singing so many different types of music that it became unimportant to succeed in that. Now that I'm doing it a little bit now, great, fantastic, I love it. But yeah, as Melissa said, this is very fulfilling, much more fulfilling than I think doing some serious opera would be.
Well, and especially because if you look at the opera industry, not that the pop industry is a beacon or anything, but the opera industry is so behind. And bless mm-hmm. the people's hearts that are really trying and having these boutique opera companies that are doing cutting edge work. And that stuff's great. And we prefer to work for companies like that. And that's exciting. But for the most part, the opera industry is really still living in a time mm-hmm. that their audience doesn't exist anymore. Mm-hmm. And I hope they pull through. But I don't. Mm-hmm. It's not looking good.
Mm-hmm.
Did that frustrate you?
Oh,
in
absolutely.
School?
And it still does. It still does. And I think in school we were under these illusions because the people that were teaching us, not all of them, but most of them, were still living in that world too.
I was very unaware, honestly. And I think now that I've met the people who I've met and I'm working with the people who I'm working with, I'm much more aware of the real inequities and the fact that there are opera companies still performing with blackface.
Are there really?
That's the ultimate insult.
God.
The Metropolitan Opera.
It's just like, are you?
Yeah.
Okay. This is a problem.
It's unacceptable.
Yeah.
And there are still companies, the Metropolitan Opera as well. I'll refer to that because that is the kind of. It's the standard,
mm-hmm.
you know, it's the place where everybody's dying mm-hmm. to perform mm-hmm. and it's kind of a dream. Well, look at their season. They have all white male composers and all white male conductors with the exception of Gustavo Dudamel. They have zero women conducting anything. They have zero, they might have, I know they did a female, they produced an opera by a female composer last year, at least one. But, you know, it's not enough. It's not enough.
Yeah.
And they are totally behind. There are opera companies out there that are trying to push the envelope. But the fact that it's still considered pushing the envelope to program a woman is absurd.
Right, right. Oh, it's, you know.
It seems like a lot of women, a lot of minorities, a lot of times it takes confidence to get to that point where you can just be like, that's not the kind of validation I want. Because in the beginning, you can often, you know, just be seeking the validation from these traditional mm-hmm. sources. And so I wonder, have you always been like, you know, this is ridiculous, like, I want to go out and do my own thing? Or did it take, you know, getting to a certain point in your politics and in your lives?
Absolutely. Yeah. It takes time. I think mm-hmm. I recently said something like, after seeing the season, the 2019-2020 season for Metropolitan Opera, I used to dream of singing at the Met. Now I have better dreams. And I totally believe that because, yeah, of course, I think it's totally natural and honest to have these dreams because these are your heroes and the icons that you sort of grow up admiring. And then you start to get older and you see you get more experienced, rather, and you see kind of the other side.
The ugly side of these things. Definitely, definitely. I think I seek and I sought validation. I still seek validation in what I do, but it's less like I must do it. I think, you know, the music we're writing is what we're feeling, and we're not afraid to share any of that or talk about any of that or write about any of that. The stuff that used to be controversial. Oh, you know, that's political, or that's a little controversial. And those ideas that were kind of ingrained to us, business for the longest time, you know, my own business and other businesses, it was, you know, you were told, you know, don't be political. You may alienate clients, you may alienate fans, and I can't see it any other way now. Screw it. So we'll alienate some fans. Fuck it.
Yeah.
It seems like that's really a not a trend, that's not the right word, but it seems like more artists and musicians are moving toward that, and almost that you can have a stronger, more loyal and fervent fan base when you are honest in that way and political. And like, you know, I mean, even you just see like Eminem being like, mm-hmm. I don't want Trump supporters as fans. Yeah. And yeah, I wonder if that feels like a risk, if that feels liberating. Tell me about being political.
It's both. Yeah. I think it's still both mm-hmm. being a risk, but this is the music we're making. That right. is what we're making right now.
I don't know what else to do. Mm-hmm. I don't know how to mm-hmm. separate the two. Mm-hmm. And do I want to alienate folks? Am I out mm-hmm. here to alienate people? No. Mm-hmm. If they feel alienated, I'm sorry. You know, you brought up Trump supporters. Do I hate Trump supporters? I don't really know a lot of them. I think we probably have a lot in common. But you know what? I'm not thinking about that when I'm writing a song. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I'm thinking about what I'm feeling right now.
Yeah, you write what you know, as they say. Uh-huh. And that's what we're feeling and experiencing and being told over the years, oh, don't be political. That's too controversial. Don't say that during a show.
Right. We had a song.
Makes you want to do it even more.
We wrote a song about Freddie Gray. It's called Gray Train. And in previous shows under different leadership, we were told, you know, we always said this song is dedicated to Freddie Gray before we sang it. And we were told, you know, we were asked not to say that by one of our former bandmates. And that's just...
Well, it's like not, it gives context for the song.
Right. Why would you do that? Yeah. Why would you write a song about, I don't know, the Daisies and not say this is about the Daisies? I just don't, it just didn't compute. So, it's not that we don't set out to piss anybody mm-mm, off mm-mm. or alienate anybody, but if in the process that's what happens, then fine.
So be it.
Yeah. I think we wouldn't be able to do what we do if we weren't just, I don't know. There's enough overthinking happening in our process mm-hmm. anyway. Like, oh, it's as good as that thing, but not content wise. Mm-hmm. We want to express ourselves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Tell me a little bit about the evolution of the band and getting to the point now where you two are Outcalls and you're the leaders and the face of Outcalls.
Sure.
Well, Outcalls began many, many years ago, and then Melissa joined, I don't know, when what year was that?
I think it might have been 2014.
Yeah, 2014.
Late 2014.
Yeah. And then Melissa collaborated on a bunch of songs, wrote a bunch of songs with that previous iteration of the group. And then the first EP was released in, I want to say, November of 2015. Yep. I had just joined the band. I recorded one piano track on the first EP, so I hadn't really done any writing of my own. And then in 2016, in summer, the band split in two. Melissa and I took out calls and decided that's what we're going to do, and we're going to keep that. And then a bunch of other band members started another band. So gosh, I can't believe that's almost 2 years ago now. Yeah. It still seems fresh and new to us. But once we started, once we were able to assume control and assume leadership roles, everything just skyrocketed in terms of making music together, recording, writing shows, booking shows, social media presence. It was very, very encouraging and exciting. And for a really long time, we felt as though we didn't have a voice. And then we had a voice, and it was liberating.
How did you have the confidence to find that voice? And in what ways do you think you were kind of being held back before?
It was a process. I think we had no choice because here we were. It was just kind of the two of us and a few other folks left over that, you know, decided, well, we want to keep making music with Britt and Melissa. So it was one of those moments where it's like, oh, shit, we're in charge now. What do we do? And we just did it. We just learned. And it was not easy. You know, we went through, we worked with a lot of different people. Some worked out, some didn't. And we played a lot of shows. Some were good. Some weren't that great. But we just kept going. And eventually, because we persevered and because Britt and I have this relationship where we've worked together a lot even before Outcalls existed. So we had that trust. But eventually we got it right. It didn't take long. It took a couple of shows, I think. And by maybe the third or fourth, we thought, okay, we have our people now. This is what we're going to do. Yeah. Okay, now let's get into the studio. Let's set some time. We only have two songs. Great. Well, we will write two more by that time. It was just like, we're going to do this and it's going to get done. It will get done. And that's been our mentality.
Yeah. Having the confidence thing, I think, is still like something in the back of my mind, that imposter syndrome, like, oh, shit, I don't know what I'm doing here, but I have to project it. Otherwise, nobody's going to have confidence in me as a leader. So just working on that still, that's certainly a challenge for me. But
we also were really lucky because I think we ended up with some of the insecurities we might have had previous to becoming the leaders. We were quickly proven wrong in our assessment that we didn't know anything, because we started working with people that they might know something more about this or that, and we had expertise in other areas, and we were lucky in that we worked with people that encouraged us and that gave us feedback saying, oh, wow, what you're doing is really special. Oh, wow, we like working with you. And it made us feel like, oh, what were we missing that whole time? Yeah. We thought we were inexperienced. So it was a combination of our own confidence, but also getting validated by our peers and people that we started collaborating with that helped us and boosted our confidence.
Yeah, feeling okay
to
ask questions.
Yeah.
Just the most basic of questions, like, what's that? And not feeling like, oh, maybe we shouldn't ask that because we should know what that is. Screw that.
That's such a thing in music, isn't it? And especially
is.
For women in music,
absolutely.
I feel. Yeah, it's like just the too cool for school. You have to know everything. Even though no one knows everything.
Right.
But just that projection. Yeah.
Yeah.
So tell me about making No King and kind of everything that came together to put that out and what you were thinking about, what inspired you.
Sure.
Poof. Yeah, No King. Well, we wrote the song No King in 2 weeks. 2 weeks, which was a challenge for us because we had a recording date set, ready to go, and we knew we wanted to title the album No King. And we needed to just make the song happen. And we did. And it was really, really cool. It was that synth sound that you hear at the beginning. I have this great little synth box that has like a million different sounds. And we were just scrolling through them one day and I found the one sound. And I remember Melissa's ears perking up and being like, oh, that's really cool. And we just played through some of those chords and No King was born. And it just came together very fast. And that was cool.
I mean, it was cool.
Really great how that happened, and I can't imagine it any other way. But yeah, no, it happened fast. I mean, we recorded that in January of 17.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, last year.
That's right, 17.
Yeah, last year. And then so we had 2 days to record 4 tracks, which was crazy and
For what we were doing and the moving parts that we had, it was
yeah. I remember like
time.
The whole day was all right, getting the band tracks down, and then at 11 p.m. it was like vocals time, and I'm like ready to fall asleep.
Right,
but we did it. We sounded really great. Yeah. And then the other tracks, Had been some songs that we had worked on for a little bit. Some of them were just introduced, Cold Blood, Bill Cosby, and then Skip to Sunrise. And then the remixes came after that. But it was our, we basically were like, we need to record. We're putting these dates on the calendar. Whatever happens, we have to make this EP.
Yeah, it was important for us, you know, going back to becoming the leaders of the group. We'd made this choice that we needed something besides our first EP. Mm-hmm. We needed something that had Brit on it because we just sounded totally different. You know, mm-hmm. we made this EP, but the way we were performing, even performing those songs from the old EP, sounded nothing like what we sounded like. I mean, yeah.
Yeah, it was a different sound.
Different vibe
totally
altogether.
Different sound.
So mm-hmm. it was important to us that, you know, here we are now, the faces of the band. We need an album or we need an EP, whatever, that reflects what we are actually doing right mm-hmm. now. And it was interesting, one of the guys that we're that we have collaborated with kind of abroad, his name's Tobias Juniel. He was a friend of mine from Colorado when I was in school back there. Anyway, we reached out to him a few times as we were going through this transition. And one of the first things he said to us was, "Oh, I'm looking at your website right now and it doesn't, and I would, when I look at this, I think you would sound like an indie rock white dude band." Mm-hmm. That's what mm-hmm. I think you'd sound like. Mm-hmm. And that was a real like, okay, we know what to do with that.
Yeah,
now.
The imagery, the right. vibe doesn't reflect who we are.
Yeah.
And very interesting. It's always good to get like tips and advice like that. But
yeah. And we ran with that advice.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, and that was kind of like, you know, we were still the leaders of the band, but just with the photos and everything, that's what we looked like. And then once No King happened, it was a total sea change in terms of vibe, mood, photos. All of that stuff started coming together really fast for us. Mm-hmm. And we released the album 9 months later. So it happened pretty quickly. Sometimes
the
I'm
length
like,
of
oh
a
my
pregnancy.
God.
Yeah,
exactly.
No, you're absolutely so funny.
Right. I never thought about it like that. That's very interesting.
You know, that's like such a cliche, like, you know, writing a book, putting out an album. It was like, you know, having a baby, but in this case, it's pretty accurate.
Moments of frustration, moments of elation, moments of tears, pain. But so thrilled with the product and funny. I mean, I felt this way once we released No King in September. I was like, when are we going back to the studio? I'm like done with these songs. I mean, I'm not done. I really enjoy listening to them, but just so ready and inspired to do the next thing.
So did No King really feel like this was like your product, like going back to finding your voices and feeling like you didn't really have one before? I mean, mm-hmm. did this feel like your voice on the
Absolutely.
Page?
Absolutely. Everything, I mean, from the artwork to the producing, everything was us, mm-hmm. you know. Of course, we had help. You know, we yeah. collaborated with people that we trust, but they were all our choices. And we worked with an incredible engineer over at Right Way Studios, Steve Wright. And working with him was such a treat because not only did he work with us and record our album, but, you know, we said, hey, can we just pick your brain, take you out for a drink or whatever? And he was always open to that. Mm-hmm. And we could ask him tons of questions mm-hmm. and, you know, talk about our insecurities with him, almost like a therapy session. He was one of the first people who said to us, well, I consider you producers on this album.
And we're like,
that's what producing is, what you're doing. And it was such a
yeah.
moment mm-hmm. for us. So, yeah, No King was really, yeah, an incredible
give me the crown.
Give me the crown.
I'm gonna say that. Give it to me. Give me the crown. Yeah. We took that crown. Took that motherfucker.
Yeah. And it looks good now. The crown looks really good.
Yeah,
it's
it
really
does.
Shiny.
It feels very good.
Yeah.
In terms of the visual elements, like you said, and just your performing style and everything, do you view that as like, you know, a true extension of yourself? Or is that a character, a projection that you like to, you know, like that you want your music to embody.
Oh, right. Like Beyonce and Sasha Fierce or whatever. Mm-hmm. No, it's definitely, I think it's me.
Yeah, I think that sometimes I'm like, oh, you know, I really gotta do this, you know, put this out there. But no, it is. At the end of the day, when I look at the pictures and my face is all screwed up, my weird, awkward singer face, I'm like, yep, that's me. That is me. Yeah, no, it is an extension.
Yeah, very personal. I mean, all these songs that we're writing are about our personal experiences mm-hmm. and thoughts. And I mean, yeah, Cold Blood, I've never murdered anybody, but you know, it was definitely there's a very specific memory attached to that song.
Yeah. And it's such a performance now.
Yeah,
it's such
right.
a, I feel like much more so even now when we do Cold Blood perform that song and the first moments are just keyboard and vocals. There's this stillness that people aren't expecting, and it's just really, it's cool to watch everybody listen to the song and be like, what's going to happen?
These girls are weird.
These girls are weird. Yeah, exactly.
But
exactly.
owning that sort Absolutely. Of character. And
it is a character. Yeah, it's just like it's like a performance. It's a performance. Totally yeah, is.
Right.
Is surprising people important to you?
Yes.
Yeah, definitely. It's fun.
Whenever we write or whenever, you know, we're doing like, okay, we're figuring out the structure to a song. My instinct is to say, let's trick people. When the chorus should go here, let's go to the next verse. And sometimes that's a good thing, and sometimes, you know, you need to give the audience what they want. But that's my thing.
In terms of, you know, collaborating so much and being in a band like this, I mean, what does that offer you that maybe if you had gone, you know, if you were only like a traditional opera singer, you wouldn't get from that experience?
Definitely the being able to make decisions, you know, mm-hmm. of course, when you approach any role or character or piece in an opera, you have decisions to make, you know, am I going to, with whatever, dynamics or tempi or mood and the way you play any, the way you act. But it's just a totally different level when it's your song, when it's something you wrote and you agonized over and you thought, oh, this word, or I'm going to try that word, or, oh, I want to, you know, like Britt was saying, put the chorus here or do the whatever here, put a fill here. It's just so different when it's yours. And it's fun. It's empowering. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And
great challenge.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. It's hard work. It's really hard work. And it makes you, well, it makes me want to explore composing for in other ways. Like, okay, well, why not write something for orchestra? Mm-hmm. Why not? It makes those things less intimidating. Something that Britt always says is you know more than you think you know. And doing this has really proven that. Mm-hmm. Like, wow, mm-hmm. Wow. I would have never imagined being in a band like this, but why did I sell myself mm-hmm. short?
Yeah. And you're in charge of the marketing and you're in charge of the, you know, in charge of sales and getting the artwork, and, you know, it's a two-person operation for a business, you know, similar mm-hmm. to the opera companies that have sales teams and ticketing and marketing, and we're doing all of that. And
merchandise.
Yeah, merchandising and everything. And collaborating with these musicians in a very different regard, you know, certainly with the conductor and your fellow singers and even the orchestra for an opera, but oh, can you play it this way? Can you try it a different? Can you, you know, stuff that maybe the conductor would say we're telling our musicians mm-hmm. to do, you know, personally?
Because it's putting your own song out there. Does that feel scarier, more vulnerable?
Less so now.
Yeah, less so now.
Less so now. At first, yeah, coming into the rehearsal space and saying, I wrote this song. Oh, God, it used to be just so terrifying. And maybe that was because of the people we were working with. But you know, I still might get a little nervous if I present an idea mm-hmm, to Britt, but it's just less so now. I think, it's easier to take those risks. Yeah. It's a safe space.
Whenever I still feel this way when we perform a new song and we say, oh, this is a new song. I'm like, oh my God, are they going to like it? And I'm less concerned if they do. You know, I'm glad we're doing it.
Yeah.
When did you both start writing music?
I started writing music in high school. I started just doing like piano stuff. I remember entering a composer's showcase in high school and writing my cheesy piano things that I feel like I still kind of do, but it's okay. So, song-wise, not until maybe 7 or 8 years ago, but I always liked to fool around on the piano.
Yeah, I think I definitely started by writing poetry, writing lyrics, and always thinking I was going to make it a song someday, but never getting there. But I think I wrote my first song in college, beginning of college, probably my freshman or sophomore year in college. Never recorded it or anything. Recorded it on a phone. But yeah, serious, like front to back, let's finish this song. Like 2015, I think, was the first time mm-hmm. when I recorded the EP.
Baltimore Rap, don't forget.
Oh, Baltimore Rap. That's right. We were in PB Jams and we wrote a rap called Baltimore Rap. Yeah.
That was our first song.
We did start experimenting writing together. Mm-hmm. That's true. Mm-hmm.
What were some of the highlights from Baltimore Rap?
It was such a jam.
It was a hit. I'm telling you, it was a hit. I mean, Melissa did an incredible rap, and I'm still kind of, every time I listen to it, I'm just, how did she come up with the rhythm and what to say? And,
well, it started as a parody because we were in a cover band. So we were doing a parody. Well, we were covering a lot of hip hop. So we did some Jay-Z, and we did Empire State of Mind because that was just the hook was killing. So we did some of that, and then we said, okay, if we're doing this New York rap, why don't we do a Baltimore New York mashup? Because we love to do these tricky arrangements of songs. Mm-hmm. Like, oh, you think this is going to be this song, but it's actually going to be this song. So it started off as a parody of Jay-Z.
And yeah, what's the lyric right before the it's we're in the real jungle out here. Jay-Z, check the library. That's an Upton Sinclair reference. I mean, just like, but it was so fun. It was like it's a Baltimore love song, truly. Mm-hmm. And it was fun to record, and all of our fans loved it and knew the chorus and would sing along with us, and that was really special.
I totally forgot about how could I do that?
No, it's okay. It's in the back of our minds. Right. That was the last song that we performed at our EP release in September.
Right.
Just the two of us came out. We taught the band how to play it, but it was a little too involved, and everybody was like at the end of their rope trying to get everything ready for the release. So I said, Melissa and I are going to play this together. That's it. And it was really like the cherry on the sundae of the release. It was so fun.
Yeah.
Is Peabody what brought you both to Baltimore?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Where are you both from originally?
Well, I was actually born in Meriden, Connecticut, but moved around a lot because my father was in the military. So we ended up in Kansas. He retired from the military when I was in third grade. So I usually say I'm from Kansas.
Mm-hmm. I'm from Connecticut.
Were you singers from a young age?
I was. My mother was a jingle singer, so she did like the Coca-Cola jingle.
That is so, so cool.
She would always sing to me, and she'd play her jingle tapes in the car, and I'd sing along with those. But she always encouraged me to sing, and she was gracious with getting me lessons. So, yeah, I always was singing.
Yeah, for as long as I can remember, I've always wanted to be a singer. Like, I never wanted to do anything else. But there was nobody in my family that was musical at all, except my grandmother. When she did laundry, she sang. Yeah. She was terrible, but I love her.
That's
but
cool.
She sang.
That's awesome.
She sang those Baptist hymns.
Ah.
And she had this voice. She smoked so many cigarettes. She had the ratchetest voice. But she still sang. And I sang in church, you know, went to church with her. And but yeah, always wanted to sing, but was always too scared. So never did any formal training. Was a band nerd instead. And then one fateful day, I was playing in the pit band for a musical, Bye Bye Birdie, my junior year of high school. And it was break time. And I got on stage while everybody was on break, and I started singing all of the songs, like on stage and doing all of the choreo. And I didn't know that there was a camera streaming into the choir room. So my friends saw and heard me singing. And I was so embarrassed, but one of my friends, J.D. Apodaca, came up to me afterward and said, girl, you need to get yourself some lessons and start singing, because that was awesome.
That's so fun.
So
that turned out so much better than it would for 99.9% of people.
I know, right?
I would have just died and never come back to school.
Well, if he wouldn't have encouraged me, I think I probably would have. But I did. I took lessons and was in the next musical. It was Hello, Dolly. So I think that was my junior year. And then my senior year, I was cast as the lead in the musical. And then from then on, I just never did anything else.
What space in Kansas mythology does Wizard of Oz occupy, especially for
a
young singer?
I was obsessed with The Wizard of Oz. You have no idea. Mm-hmm. I used to watch that movie every day.
You're not a was, you are.
Oh, I still am.
Yeah.
I still am very much to this.
I love that movie.
So it's not just like a Kansas cliche, because I don't know anything about Kansas. So I didn't want to stereotype.
I never really put the two together, but you're right.
Anytime you tell somebody you're from Kansas, you're going to get a Wizard of Oz.
Yeah, that's like my only frame of reference.
Really?
Like, you've never heard that joke. Okay, okay.
I should brush up on my jokes.
Wizard of Oz was a very special movie, and I loved Judy Garland. That might have been one of the reasons why I was obsessed with singing, was because of that movie. Yeah, and The Little Mermaid. I was obsessed with that movie,
too. I loved The Little Mermaid. Yeah. Oh, my gosh. That music, that still makes me cry at the end when she leaves her dad. Remember,
yeah.
I'm like, oh.
He was an asshole, though. He deserved to be left.
Oh, my God. But it's still very touching.
Yeah.
But yes, you're right. You're right.
Without calls, do you guys have ambitions? Are you just like, you know, having fun with it, or are there, you know, certain things you want to accomplish, certain audiences you want to reach?
Absolutely.
We're going to the top.
Yeah, we're going all the way to the tippy top.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We want Grammys and
several Grammys.
Yeah. Maybe, yeah. I don't know, maybe five or six.
I mean, definitely fun. We definitely want to have fun, but we are, this is a life style. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Are you looking to EGOT?
Oh, yeah.
What's that?
Emmy, Grammy, Oscar, Tony. Oh, yeah,
that's a great
cool.
idea.
That
yeah,
would be
definitely.
Cool.
Let's add that
it's
to
always
list.
Composers who EGOT. It's usually not, you know, like actors and stuff, because it's easier to span all of them. But I think alcohols can do it.
I think yeah, so let's too. Do it. See, I like we that. Could. I like the way you're thinking.
We want to be like those old hoes that are like producers. Mm-hmm. You know, get some great sunglasses.
Absolutely. And yeah, to think about being like producing some young band like we were at some point is very cool. And I think I don't consider myself a producer, but I have and I am. And I think pursuing that and going in that direction in the future, now, whenever, is a very cool thing to think about.
Yeah.
You guys like seem to draw from a lot of diverse music styles and influences and everything. Is there anything you're seeing, like when you think of, you know, being a producer, that is really exciting to you, or, you know, any styles, any young up and coming musicians that you're like, you know, that is the future?
So many. Yeah. Oh my gosh. Well, I mean, I love what Frank Ocean is doing with pop music. Ocean. You know, he's just really just weirding out.
Yeah. I mean, the more ways. Vulnerability, I think, with vocals, I think of how SZA did her recent album and Frank Ocean similarly, just marrying of styles. Like, you have the R&B styles with this kind of jazzy guitar. I feel like that's very, very popular right now. And less auto-tune, I'm always into that. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're cracking or you're sounding not perfect, sounds good to me. I mean, I'm still like, even recording and listening to me singing back, I'm like, oh, can you fix that? Oh, can you fix that? And I'm trying to get out of that, you know. It's okay. It's who you are, and that's how you sound, and it's not bad. You're the only person who thinks that. It's cool. There's so many changes. I mean, there's so many things that you can do on your computer.
Yeah, that would be great. I love thinking about making an album in my basement, like many of our peers do.
Absolutely.
So successfully.
Absolutely. Oh,
so cool.
It's yeah, the ease.
Yeah.
And the technology and the, oh, you got to get this little thing and this thing and that's it.
It's almost like you guys are coming to music from the opposite experience of, like you said, a lot of your peers. It's like a lot of people are starting out in their basements and their bedrooms, and they aspire to get more polished and to learn more of the classical side of things. And you guys are coming to it from this very polished classical style. And do you feel like you're at all like deconstructing your knowledge?
Adding to, I mean, that's an interesting point. We trained without microphones and without any gear. That was the whole point, was that we use our body to produce
amplify.
The sound, right, and to amplify. And yeah, but I don't think it's deconstructing. I think it's more how do we use what we have in this arena, and how can we apply what we know? Yeah, of course, we had to study sound waves and sine waves and blah 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 when we were studying like vocal pedagogy. So how does that apply to running sound and the you know, the little bars and things that you're looking at, and this button and that button?
That's interesting. I never think of it as deconstructing. Just I'm a sponge taking in all that knowledge, and how can I add on to this?
So what's next for Outcalls?
Well, we have a busy April. We have a bunch of shows. I feel like we have one a weekend besides Easter. So a bunch of shows coming up, and then we are also working to our full-length album, which will be released sometime next year, hopefully.
Yeah, we're playing Light City.
Light City, yes.
And we're kicking off Light City with the Federal Hill parade and after party, which we're playing with Super City. We're going to Pittsburgh for a show, and we're planning a tour for August, a two-week summer tour, Northeast. We're going to hit Toronto, Philly, Brooklyn, probably Vermont and Maine as well. And full-length album, which is going to be a response to the women need to step up comment made after the Grammys, which we all know that women have been stepping up.
Mm-hmm.
But our inspiration for the album is to highlight female artists that have been stepping up and to research, learn more about those that have come before us. We want to experiment with writing some skits and interviewing people.
Yeah, we have a whole idea for interludes. I mean, similar to what we're seeing with SZA and Frank Ocean and many other artists, not just focusing on the 11 to 12 track album that we will be releasing, having 30-second to minute little transitions between songs that highlight our friends, our some people not our friends, our colleagues who have been in the industry or starting out, have experiences to share. A lot of different ideas. We have a lot of ideas. Who knows what will materialize? Yeah.
That's the idea.
Mm-hmm. Well, Britt and Melissa, thanks for coming in today.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for listening to my conversation with Britt Olson-Ecker and Melissa Wimbish of Outcalls. I'm Quinn Kelly, and this is a Baltimore Sun podcast. Female Trouble is available everywhere you can listen to podcasts, and it helps us out to subscribe and leave a rating. You can find more at baltimoresun.com/femaletrouble or on Twitter at FMLTrouble. Our theme song is Dope Girls by Shifty, featuring TT the Artist. Thanks again.